Good evening, everyone. As explained earlier, I'm not dead. But he's not going to be here next week, so we're going to do Jonah in hopefully two parts. Hopefully I don't go too fast and end up having to pick something else for next week. But I put together some notes, and as many of you know, I'm not usually one for putting up PowerPoint slides. But then I wanted to put together a timeline, and I realized that we don't have a whiteboard for me to draw on, so I said, well, PowerPoint is now a necessity. So I said, well, while I'm at it, we'll put together some notes for the impatient because it felt appropriate for the subject anyway. So we've got Jonah here. So what I want to go through before we actually get into the text too much, we'll read the first verse, is talk a little bit about the setting, the context, and why I think the book is important. And then we'll actually go through the text for the latter half of this class and for the majority of next week. Before we start, Rob, can I ask you to lead us in a prayer? All right. So many of you are familiar with the internet. TLDR is too long, didn't read. It's four chapters, guys. It's not that long. But in case it's too long to read, the whole gist of the book, I think, can be summarized in a couple of points that are going to be very important. And we're going to go over these in detail as we go through. But I wanted to put them up here as both a teaser for what we're going to talk about for 2 weeks, as well as an aid so that if you fall asleep in the middle of it, you can wake up and still remember what it is that we're talking about. The first thing is the fairly obvious one, that God is a number of attributes that we see throughout other books in the Bible, but are kind of displayed in a different way here, because the majority of the Bible takes place in fairly small geographic areas at any given time. When you have the children of Israel, when they become the children of Israel, and they're stuck in Egypt. Those storylines happen in Egypt. And then they move, and they're on the move, but at any given time, all the people are together. And over time, they take over the land of Israel, and you read stories about them taking over this land, and this land, and this land, and then you look at a map, and it's like, you know, a couple of counties of Texas. It's small. Very small geographical areas, right? So it's not big. And so, even though we know intellectually that point, that God is everywhere, at any given time, many of the Bible stories occur in a fairly small geographic region. There's not a whole lot of travel outside of the book of Acts to large geographical areas. And this is another one of them, where Jonah, as many know, tried to run away from God and found out you can't do that because God is everywhere. He is over all. That's another thing that we know. He is the only God, and he's over all things. But we find out that he has reign over not just the Israelites, but over all nations, and that he is the same for all time. And I think that's the one that we get out of understanding what it is that he wants out of people and the message that Jonah brings to the Ninevites and the way they respond and the way God responds is the same way that God responds to us today when we come up with the same response. So there are a number of attributes of God that we see throughout the scriptures, and many of them are reflected here. The second thing is that God had expectations of other nations besides Israel. And that's an important thing, because a lot of people think that for the Gentiles, there was just nothing until Jesus. that there was no possible way that people could have any sort of relationship or understanding or knowledge of God prior to Christ. And the fact is that God has existed over all people for all time. Before Abraham, there were people pleasing to God. And after Abraham became a nation, there were people that had the ability to please God, and many of them joined the Jewish nation. We hear stories of Rahab and of Ruth and people who actually, you know, were granted the gift of being in the lineage of Jesus even. But there were others who came from afar off, who were in their own way, in their own lives, pleasing to God because they followed the rules that he had set forth. And we'll see some of that as we go through. And we even see the fact that there was provisions made for people, even after their initial failure. Because one could say, well, if you were a perfect person and never made a mistake, then of course you would still be in God's good graces. But as Romans says, all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, right? So that's not a realistic expectation. So was there a way for people to come back and have a relationship with God after they had messed up? I think we'll see that there is. And the third thing, and this is the thing that I find most interesting about the book of Jonah, is that God's plan for salvation is both simple and convoluted. It's simple for us. We can understand it. We have the Bible. We can look through and say, ah, I understand what I have to do to be saved. I understand how I can interact with God and be his child and attain the salvation that he has set before us. And yet, if you look at how hard it was to bring that salvation about, and the circumstances over centuries, and the weaving of patterns from nation after nation and people after people that all contributed things that led toward Christ, it wasn't just the story of the Jews. It was the whole world that God orchestrated, and the events of the world, and the nations that rose and fell and rose again, that was all to bring about Christ. And it's amazing to look at. And I want to go over some of that first. So even though these are the 3 points in, I think, order of obviousness, what I want to do is cover that third thing first, because it has to do with the setting. Now, I said we weren't going to go into the text, but again, here's the first verse. Now, the word of the Lord came to Jonah, the son of Amittai, saying... Okay, so we know that this is a book about Jonah, the son of Amittai. There's not much other historical context given in Jonah. So we say, what time period was it? When was this written? Who was it written by? Well, probably Jonah, but when? When did this occur? When did the events occur? When was it written? But we get some good context clues if you look at 2 Kings. So turn with me, if you will, to the book of 2 Kings. We're going to go to the 14th chapter. I'm not as fast in turning in my real Bible anymore because I've gotten far too used to the electronic version. But I find that for standing up here, my eyes aren't quite good enough to read off a tiny screen. Starting in verse 23. 2 Kings 14, starting in verse 23, says, in the 15th year of Amaziah, son of Joash, king of Judah, Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel, became king in Samaria, and he reigned 41 years. He did evil in the sight of the Lord. He did not depart from all the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin. He restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the Sea of Arabah, according to the word of the Lord, the God of Israel, which he spoke through his servant Jonah, the son of Amittai, the prophet, who was at Gath-Hepher. For the Lord saw the affliction of Israel, which was very bitter, for there was neither bond nor free, nor was there any helper for Israel. The Lord did not say that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. So we've got Jonah mentioned during this time period, so we can look and say, ah! Well, we know when Jeroboam II reigned, so we know, generally, when Jonah was speaking. And that was about 790-ish when he would have began his ministry. So that's 790 BC, and What else do we know about 790 BC? Well, that was a pretty low period of history for Israel. Obviously, from the text here, it was a low point for the people in terms of their spiritual state. Jeroboam was a very wicked king, and the people themselves were in a low state as far as the oppression that they were getting from the outside, and it was not a great time for Israel. And so there would have been a lot of just hard feelings going around just in general, not only among themselves, but of the other nations who were oppressing them. But there was also, at a similar time, an ebb in the political force in Assyria, which was a major power, but they had just come out of a civil war in about 830-ish, 820, 830. There was a civil war in Assyria, and their sort of military power had sort of taken a dip. And that didn't actually start to increase again until Tiglath-Pileser started moving his forces around and expanding the empire again in 745, which is actually about 50 years after the events of this, 45, 50 years after the events of Jonah. So there's a lull right now in Assyria, which makes it a fairly decent time and a receptive time, we'll find, for Jonah to go and preach to them. But at the same time, Assyria was known as a harsh and cruel people. They were a nation of war, known to do terrible things to the people that they had conquered. And so there was not good feelings from pretty much anybody towards Assyria, much less the people of God. But there's lasting effects to what God does. So if we look at the whole timeline here, and I went ahead and laid it out. I didn't put numbers here. Do we have a laser pointer on this thing? Is it this? Aha! So, starting here, that's 800 BC. Ending over here, that's 100 AD. So every tick mark is 100 years. Just, they're evenly spaced. Take my word for it. Because I put one at the front, one at the end, and I said, arrange horizontally, and it distributed them. I said, aha! Okay, so anyway, we start here at 790 with Jonah, okay? So he's going to talk to the citizens of Nineveh and get them to turn around. Now, this is important because if he had not repented, we know the story of Jonah, right? What was going to happen to Nineveh if the people of Nineveh didn't repent? It was going to be destroyed, right? Well, what was Nineveh? It was the capital, right? Generally speaking, does a nation survive the destruction of its capital? No, usually that happens because you've been conquered, right? You don't lose your capital as the first opening salvo of a war. That's kind of the end of a thing. However, if Assyria wasn't a nation in power, what happens here at 720 where Assyria conquers Israel? It might have been a little different. God was still going to judge the nation. He said so. But would it have been Assyria? Well, if they had been destroyed, probably not. But Assyria was a really interesting country. And it turns out that when you conquer a people, you have to have a philosophy to keep them quiescent after you conquer them. Because when you leave, you don't want people to immediately rebel. You want them paying taxes. You want quiet. Peace. Well, how do you accomplish that? The Assyrians said, well, if these people are in the same land as their God, then they can still interact with their God. They can call on them and try to come back to battle. So what we'll do is we'll scatter everybody into the other nations that we conquer, and we'll just kind of mix and match people around, and then people will be away from their gods, and they can't do anything, and they'll just have to pay us taxes. Okay. Well, that was their philosophy. Spoiler alert, it didn't work. It was a terrible idea. And for the most part, when you move people to entirely different geographic regions, they don't actually know how to till the land properly. And so economics kind of got messed up and things weren't really great. And Babylonians had a great time taking all that over and fixing it with their new philosophy, which was, we're going to take all the young people and train them to be good Babylonians. And then we'll send them back and they can be the new rulers. And then they'll pay us taxes and there will be quiet. Hint, that worked a little better, but still not great. But the point here is that right in between here, so Jonah's already happened, Isaiah comes along, and somewhere in his ministry, Isaiah is not perfectly chronological, so Isaiah 2 happens somewhere. A statement gets made. It says, in those days, all the nations of the earth will flow to it. Speaking of Zion and the return and the coming of this great nation. And we know that there's connections between Joel 2 and Isaiah 2. I didn't talk about Joel, actually. He's back at 900. So he's actually, even before then, when we're going to start off this chain. But we've got Joel 2, we've got Isaiah 2. Later on, we have Daniel 2. And all those things, we're going to find out later, are fulfilled in Acts, the second chapter. But Isaiah prophesies and says, all nations are going to flow in to Israel. So then 720 happens, and Assyria conquers Israel and creates what's called the diaspora, which is the spreading, right? They just spread Jews everywhere. Created little pockets of civilization down in Alexandria and Spain, just everywhere. The spreading of the Jewish nation happened first with Assyria and later with the other conquering nations. Babylon conquers Assyria in 605. They take over. In the same year, that was the Battle of Carchemish. In the same year, they take the first captives from Israel. They start training them. They take the second group of captives in 597, and in 586, they conquer Jerusalem for the third and final time as far as Babylon is concerned. And that's the judgment of the southern two tribes. Later on, in 540, Persia conquers Babylon. And 4 years later, prophecy that I don't have up here that says that they'll be in captivity for 70 years is fulfilled when Daniel entreats the king to let people go back. He says, hey, it's been 70 years, and it's prophesied you by name that you're going to let people go. And they go back. Now, 540 years later, there's some wise men that show up from the east to visit Jesus. How do you think they knew what to look for? But the people in here, they got moved forcibly in their captivity out to those regions. 35 years later, roughly, the day of Pentecost happens in Acts the second chapter. In Acts the second chapter in verse 5. Somebody turn and read Acts 2, 5 and 6. Now, how would those people have come from every nation and start speaking every language except for the fact that they had been spread there and they had become residents there and they'd taken on some of those cultural aspects like the language? Otherwise, have you ever thought about it? If everybody still just spoke Hebrew, Peter and the rest of the apostles had a real easy job. They're still preaching to Jews at the time. Just speak Hebrew, you're fine. But Acts 2 occurs, and they speak every language, and part of that miracle is because they're speaking the languages of all these people that had been spread out in the diaspora, that happened because the Assyrians conquered Israel, that happened because Assyria was still a nation because Jonah had prophesied to them. So the effects of prophecy, the effects of little things, have long-lasting consequences, leading all the way through the plan of God to bring about this great nation. And he lays out prophecy after prophecy and the way he weaves the nations such that when it occurs, you can look back hundreds of years and see the threads that were started so carefully just to bring about Christ, just to bring about a common salvation for everybody. And I think that's amazing. I do. I really think it's just cool. It gives me little shivers sometimes when I do things like this because I put together the little timelines and I go, that's a long time. 800 years is a long time. And that's just one thread. I mean, you can go all the way back to Adam, obviously, and the first prophecy is there in the Garden of Eden when they sin, and the prophecy of bruising Satan's head comes about. But even here, you get little things interspersed throughout the story, little things pointing to Christ coming, little things pointing to an age that's going to be better. But even that, even all of it pointing there, still had impact right then. Because what was God concerned about in 790? But that Nineveh, hundreds of thousands of people, had no relationship with God. And he wanted it. He wanted them to come back to him. And so he sent a prophet to go save a nation that had spurned him. That's pretty cool. Now, in talking about Jonah, it's easy to be harsh, it's easy to be overly forgiving, but it's difficult to be fair to the actual story of what's going on. We went over the setting. Jonah's a prophet, interacting with a wicked king of Israel, interacting with an Israel who was downtrodden. And the word of the Lord came to Jonah, saying, "Arise, go to Nineveh, the great city, and cry against it, for their wickedness has come up before me." Now, I might read this passage and think, all right, great. Jonah's thinking, I get to go, you know, tell these people that their doom is incoming, and then I'll get to watch it get destroyed, and Israel will be in a slightly better place because one of our oppressors is gone. But obviously the context is important here, because when God says to a prophet to go tell these people that what they're doing is wrong, the implication is that God is willing for them to turn around and repent. And we'll see later that Jonah knew that. And he says, okay, you can just see him doing the mental math here. He's like, I give it like a 10% chance that these people listen. But even if only 10% of the chance, if only 10% of the people listen, now man, even if like 5% of the people listen, you know what? God will probably relent. And that means they won't be destroyed. Oh man, I better not say anything. So Jonah runs. Jonah rose up to flee to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. So he went down to Joppa, found a ship which was going to Tarshish, paid the fare, and went down to it to go with them to Tarshish from the presence of the Lord. Now, just think about that for a minute. Of the Israelites, who were the people who had the most information about God? Priests and prophets, right? Priests because they were the keepers of the law, prophets because God spoke often directly to them. Jonah is one of those two categories of people. Does Jonah know that God is everywhere? Theoretically, yes. The idea should be there, right? Because Jonah should know as a prophet, this is the same God who brought us out of Egypt. This is the same God who spoke to Abraham. We're talking about Jehovah here, right? We haven't just suddenly changed gods. Like, he's a priest of Jehovah. This seems maybe a little bit more emotionally driven rather than intellectually driven. He rose to flee from God. That's not going to work. God is everywhere. But I think you can see some of the character here. He feels so strongly about this subject that he says, nope, we're going to do something entirely different. I'm going away. And the reason I stopped here is because I think a lot of times we fall into the same category. And we try to give Jonah, again, too much leeway or we're too harsh on him. But, you know, how often is it that we as Christians decide that we want to do something that isn't right, and in our little human convoluted brains, we go, okay, well, if I just do it over here, nobody will know. It's like, do you not realize that, yes, of course, God is going to know that you're doing this sin. He's everywhere. You can't hide from God. So, yeah, Jonah tries to hide from God in the same way that many of us try to hide from God. There's nothing that is hidden from his sight. Jonah probably knows this, but again, in his own mind, he's going to hide. He's going to run away. So the sailors became afraid. So the Lord hurled a great wind on the sea, and there was a great storm on the sea, so the ship was about to break up. The sailors became afraid, and every man cried to his God, and they threw the cargo which was in the ship in the sea to lighten it for them. But Jonah had gone below into the hold, laid down, and fallen sound asleep. We want to talk about things in two categories. And I actually brought a book here in case I get a little flustered and need to read a couple of sentences out, because I really like the way Homer Haley put in things in two categories. He talks about acts of God and miracles. And I hadn't really thought of it that way, but we actually kind of deal with acts of God even today in insurance language, right? When you cover things against acts of God, that's hurricanes and, you know, terrible weather patterns and fires and all that kind of stuff. And really, that's a category that transcends time. We're not really worried about it. It is something that is natural event, but that is of God's doing, okay? That's the literal definition here. So we're not talking about something that is supernatural, right? So a storm coming up, does that happen on the Mediterranean? Yes. Is there anything that cries miracle about that storm coming up right then? Not particularly. Is there anything that cries miracle, again, supernatural, about the storm calming down as soon as Jonah is thrown into the waves? No. Actually, no. There's nothing supernatural about a storm stopping. Okay, storms can rise and fall fairly quickly. You know, in South Florida, we used to have sun showers where it'd just be raining out of a clear sky, and then it stops. That's perfectly natural. It's weird, but it's natural. However, in this context, while not being supernatural, is it an act of God? And that, we can say yes, because he tells us so. Because God started the storm, and God stopped the storm. So it was his action working within the boundaries of natural phenomena. Okay? We're going to skip ahead here. Everyone knows the story of Jonah. We're going to start with that. Everyone knows the story of Jonah. Raise your hand if you do not know the story of Jonah. Okay. Jonah is then swallowed by a very large sea creature. It's referred to as a sea monster by Jesus. It's referred to as a great fish here in the book. Again, is it possible within the natural world for a person to be swallowed whole by a sea creature? Yes. There are creatures plenty large enough to swallow people. Is it naturally possible for a person to survive for 3 days inside belly of said creature? No. That is not possible. That's a miracle, okay? Supernatural. There's natural acts of God. God is throughout this whole story. God is causing things to happen. But there's natural and there's supernatural. Jonah being eaten is an act of God, because God causes the creature to be there at the right time to swallow Jonah and later on to vomit him out. Both of those, to one degree or another, are natural phenomena. But in between, in saving his life for 3 days, that is not a natural phenomena. Not only is it an act of God, it's actually a miracle. And we have to be careful when we're looking at things like that, because there is so much that is amazing and that is miraculous in the Bible that we don't have to make up miracles to make God any bigger. And I think in some ways it's even more amazing to look at the times when God doesn't even need to use something out of the ordinary, when God uses natural phenomena that would occur otherwise, but uses them at specific times and in specific ways in order to carry out his will. When a plague of locusts destroyed crops in Egypt, was that a natural phenomena? Absolutely. But the way in which it occurred was anything but normal. And you look at something else, like when hailstones fell and killed all the people who were assailing Israel, and none of the Israelites were touched. Was the hailstorm miraculous? This is a trick question. Yes and no. No, hailstorms happen all the time. It's perfectly normal for hailstorms to happen. What isn't normal is for them only to strike and kill all the people that are on one side of a battle and literally no one else. That's not normal. Miracle within a natural phenomenon. In Jonah, miracle within a natural phenomenon. We have a great sea creature. Doesn't matter what kind. If you want to call it a whale, I got no problem with that. It's unlikely, but maybe. But it's a large creature, and it eats Jonah. And God keeps him alive and delivers him after Jonah prays, safely, to present his word on another occasion. What do you get out of the first chapter of Jonah in looking at the way Jonah reacts and the way God reacts? What are the kinds of things that you notice? Rob. I think we also see, similar to the very first slide, that we've got impatience and patience on display. Jonah acts impetuously and leaves. Doesn't think it through. He just says, you know what? I'm going to get on the boat. I'm getting out of here. And God's got this all planned out. And not only that, but God, in his patience, saves the life of Jonah, and in so doing, manages to so impress a group of Gentile sailors into believing in Jehovah God. So he uses Jonah's disbelief as a tool for evangelism. That's thinking ahead, which is the opposite of what Jonah's doing here. And we see the contrast between Jonah's mind and God's mind throughout the story. And that's what we want to pick up here, is what is the human perspective? It's understandable because we're human. We can look at it and go, yeah, I get why he would do that. And then God turns around and says something different, and we have to stop there and say, okay, but why? Because that's the important perspective. We actually shouldn't care about what it was that Jonah was thinking, because that's human. Anybody can get there. But what God was thinking is what the whole book was put there for. What was God thinking here? Well, he had a message to deliver, and he had a prophet to deliver it with. So he was going to preserve that prophet, and in so doing, teach him a lesson, and bring him back. So even in Jonah's disobedience, God was patient with Jonah. Even in Jonah's disobedience, God was still going to accomplish his purpose. So you're not going to just stop God's purpose by individually failing. All you're going to do is exclude yourself. And yet, You see God willing to bring him back, willing to continue using. It's not that just God got Jonah out of the picture and brings another prophet and says, okay, prophet number two, you're going to go talk to Nineveh. He says, nope, we're going to work with Jonah. Give him a chance. We'll work with you. And Jonah does his job, and later on, Jonah says, man, I told you that that was going to happen. You go, okay, we're going to work with Jonah some more. And that's the story, is that God is just patient. God is working through his people. He does. He does. And that actually gets into another interesting perspective. Again, without diving too deep into the text here, one of the interesting things is there are three basic schools of thought about Jonah. And that actually covers most prophets or most historical contexts in the Old Testament in general, is that there's a mythical view of it, which is basically that it's just a story that grew up, has no basis in reality, and is essentially just a legend. There's an allegory, which is that it may have some basis in truth, but is used in particular of Jonah, talking more about the Israelite captivity and God's patience with them and bringing them through and a return being prophesied. So people can view it as an allegory. And the third is the historical view, which is to say that, no, Jonah was a real person, and he was sent to Nineveh, and they repented, and God relented on the destruction that he was going to bring to Nineveh. And there are arguments that people can make on all three of them, but at the end of the day, only one of them makes sense, because as soon as Jesus brings about the story of Jonah to talk about his own death, he's validating the story that is presented as fact in the prophets. So there's, besides that, the rest of the story, if you want to sort of pick and choose pieces that do and don't happen, it makes it very difficult to then hold any particular stance on holding the rest of the Bible as historically accurate. So when we look at this, if we want to pick any of the Bible as historically accurate, we kind of have to look at Jonah and say, okay, well, this is a piece of history that we've got to study as a historical piece, as opposed to simply an allegory that talks about the nation of Israel. And that's actually important, because if it was only an allegory about the children of Israel, what would that say about God's relationship with other nations? Nothing, right? I mean, if it's just about Israel, it doesn't give us any information on what God thought about other nations, on what God was willing to do for other nations. And because most of the Old Testament focuses on the Israelites and their relationship with God, we get very few instances where we can look in and say, aha, well, in this particular time, God relented on a punishment to a group of people who by all means deserved it. You can look at the Assyrian history and say, wow, that was a terrible people. If anyone deserved destroying, it was probably them. And yet, God here is showing his patience and his willingness to work with a group of people, his willingness to forgive a group of people based on their actions, based on their repentance. And that says that we're following the same God that we are following today, right? It's that God doesn't change. That was the third point. It's that he's the same for all time, right? In one of the things that we try to understand in our feeble minds is you know, how do we interact with this God? Is it different? Is there a different God of the Old Testament versus a God of the New Testament? And a lot of people really struggle with that. And they say, well, you've got, they try to categorize it as, you've got vengeful God and then you've got loving God. And so we can't take anything from the Old Testament because all of those stories were about vengeance. It's like, I don't know how you read the book of Jonah and come up with that. You know, you've got a God who's so loving of a people that have completely spurned him that he's willing to relent on destruction and go through, you know, his own people to do so, knowing that those people are going to turn around later and conquer his own chosen people. That's love. That's patience. There's no other reading of that you can do and come up with just a God of vengeance here. So it makes it very important to understand this as a historical context so that we can understand God's nature as being a God of both justice and grace. Yeah, and you know it's interesting because that's mostly a study for the book of Romans, where we talk about who has law and who doesn't, because Paul's whole argument is that no one ever, in the history of ever, has been without law. As far back as Adam, there was a law for Adam. It was a pretty simple law: tend the garden, and don't touch that tree. You have one job. See how well that worked. However, even people with one job, you know, it's not going to go well. But moving forward from Adam, we have Noah and the laws that were passed down to him from getting off of the ark. Well, there's a basis, if for no other reason, if no other laws ever got made for anyone else, who all is descended from Noah? Everybody, right? The whole rest of the world's been destroyed at that point, except for these eight people. And the law passed down to them says, you'll do these things. Okay, well, there is a basis by which people can be pleasing or not pleasing to God based on that law. More laws were given over time, and we know some of them, and we don't know most of them. The ones we know about are important because they led to Christ. The ones we don't know about aren't important for us today because they don't directly lead towards Christ. The whole point of keeping the Jewish records and the law around was because of how it led into Christ, because of how Christ fulfilled that law and brought about the new law that now everyone is under. That's the importance there. But we lose sight of that because we say, oh, okay, well, we've got the Bible. That's everything that God has ever done for anybody. And that's mishandling it. God has done things for people of all ages. And we just don't have enough text to have all that. We don't even have enough text to hold all the things that Jesus did. You know, John says at the end of his gospel that if I were to try to write down everything that Jesus did, I suppose the whole world wouldn't be able to fill the volumes. Well, that's just one time period of all the times that God has been active in this world. So it's important, I think, when we look back at a book like Jonah, to understand those little tidbits of how he deals with other nations. Any other comments on chapter 1 here before we start looking into chapter 2? We've got about 3 minutes left. So what I want to do real quickly is just read Jonah's prayer, because I find it interesting. And Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the stomach of the fish, and he said, I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me. I cried for help from the depth of Sheol, and you heard my voice. For you had cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the current engulfed me. All your breakers and billows passed over me, so I said, I have been expelled from your sight. Nevertheless, I will look again toward your holy temple. Water encompassed me to the point of the dip, to the point of death. The great deep engulfed me. Weeds were wrapped around my head. I descended to the roots of the mountains. The earth with its bars was around me forever. But you have brought up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. While I was fainting away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. Those who regard vain idols forsake their faithfulness, but I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. That which I have vowed, I will pay. Salvation is from the Lord. It's an amazing kind of prayer. Not just because of the obvious sentiment that goes in. You have Jonah has just been saved from death and is being sustained in a miraculous fashion, and he recognizes this. But what he goes back to in talking to the Lord is the same kinds of things that you read about in the Psalms. He praises the Lord first and foremost for how great he is and how far Jonah had fallen and yet the Lord was able to reach him. That right there, I think, tells me that Jonah learned that lesson. There's intellectual knowledge. There's things that we understand from a theory point of view. And then there's reality. When things become real to you is when wisdom happens. And I think this is the beginning of Jonah's wisdom. You get the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. But even more so here, when he starts to understand the reality, there's no depth that God can't reach. There's no distance that God can't be found or that he can't find you. And Jonah's prayer reflects that. He says, you know what? I was in the bowels of the earth and you saved me. And I will pay that debt. You think he understood why he was being punished? And do you think with this, he understood that he had a job to do? And that's us. We're all guilty before God. And he saves us from the depths. But that means that we have a job to do. And that's what we'll pick up with next week.